Well, we're in Esther chapter 9 tonight, and we're going to look at verses 1 through 17. We're not going to finish the book tonight. It's going to be next week that we'll finish. But I want to look at these first 17 verses here in Esther chapter 9. And I've given the message this title, or the study tonight, this title, D-Day in Persia. And 473 B.C. was the year. D-Day in Persia. You know, sometimes we look ahead to dates on a calendar, and we've got a great anticipation for those dates. Sometimes it might be a date with some anxiety involved in it. We look ahead to weddings. You know, usually the wedding invitations go out months and months in advance, and so people have to mark off the date on the calendar, and the date gets closer and closer, and finally arrives. Christmas, a lot of times, you know, usually sometime in the fall, we all start looking forward to Christmas, and so we know what date that is. This year, we have on the calendar Election Day, which will be first Tuesday in November, and so that's always an important day on our calendar. Back in 1944, there was a date on the calendar that everyone knew was coming. There was a planned invasion during World War II, and it was originally scheduled for June the 5th, but it was really bad weather that day, and so Eisenhower, who was in charge of all of the troops, he put it off till the next day, and so on June the 6th, 1944, we know what that date is in history. It was D-Day. Now, the date that we've got in mind here tonight in our study is March. It was March the 7th. Of 473 B.C., and it was the date that had been set up, and really you come to the climax of the whole story of Esther in tonight's study. You recall that two edicts had been issued with the king's approval. The first one was when Haman, they rolled the pur, they're called, the lots, and they came up with the 13th day of the month of Adar, which is the 12th month of the year. And it was 11 months ahead of time when they did this, but they came up with that date, which is the 13th of that month, of the 12th month. And they said that on that day, the enemies of the Jews could kill them. That was what Haman had wanted to do. And so that went out throughout the entire kingdom. And then you recall that the edict said this. It said, you can destroy, kill, annihilate all of the Jews and plunder their possessions. And so it was going to be an act of genocide that was set up on that day. All the Jews could be destroyed and annihilated. But later on, and we won't go into all the details of the story, there was a second edict that was issued after Esther had intervened with the king. And this edict said the Jews could gather together to defend themselves. And that was 8 months in advance. So it gave them 8 months to prepare for that date of the first one. And the reason they had to do that, of course, is because of the laws of the Medes and the Persians. We've been over and over that. But this was a greatly anticipated day throughout the entire empire. Can you imagine having something like this that everybody knew was coming? This day was going to, you know, come about. It was going to happen. And so it finally arrives here in the ninth chapter, and we're going to look at, as I said, the first 17 verses tonight, and this will probably be, for most of you that are here tonight, this will probably be the best exposition of those 17 verses that you've ever heard. Probably you've never heard any other exposition of these verses. But I've got a simple outline, 2 points, the description of that day, verses 1 through 5, and then the death and destruction of that day, verses 6 through 17, and I have a few sub-points on that one. So let's just start in verse 1, and the first 5 verses, the description of that day. There's just sort of a general description that's given here. It says, now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. Now, speaking here really about the one where the Jews could be killed, but we keep in mind that there were two decrees that could be executed that day. And on the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. And so the exact opposite of what was supposed to have happened, what they those that hated the Jews, it was a complete reversal from what they wanted and what they expected. Verse 2, the Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, those who were planning to carry out Haman's edict. And I read the commentary that John Whitcomb wrote on Esther. The title of the little book is Esther and the Destiny of Israel. Listen to what he said. He said, "It is easy to underestimate the hatred that multitudes of people throughout the empire sustained toward the Jews, and thus to misunderstand the response of the Jews to their potential tormentors. Haman's letter that he had sent out had either created or fanned the flames of anti-Semitism throughout the entire empire. Whether motivated by Haman's propaganda or their own greed, thousands of enemies of the Jews were eagerly awaiting the appointed day." And probably that latter thing has as much to do with it as anything, because you remember part of that edict was that they could take the plunder from the people that they killed. And so there were probably a lot of bad people who were wanting to do that. They knew that there was a risk involved because the king had given the Jews an opportunity to defend themselves. But, there were some who were there just wanting to gain the riches. And it says there at the end of verse 2 that no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. And then in verse 3 it says, "All the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them." The word had gotten out that the king now favored the Jews. But for it says in verse 4, "For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent." And so it's, the very fact that Mordecai had been promoted to second in command indicated that what the king thought about the Jews. And it says in verse 5, this is sort of a summary of the entire day, what happened on that day. It says, "Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them." And so, it seems a little bit like, as you begin to read this account, you'd say, well, couldn't the Jews have shown some restraint? But you got to understand, these other people were out to kill them. That's what you have to keep in mind. If they didn't respond in the way that they did very strongly, they were going to suffer great loss themselves. And so they sprung into action on that day. They had a plan. They gathered together, and they executed their plan, and it was greatly successful. And so that's the description of that day, and a great reversal that took place. The second thing we see is the death and destruction of that day in verses 6 through 17. I've got several subheadings here. The first one is the initial casualty reports. Anytime you have something like this going on, you begin to get reports of the casualties that take place. And in verse 6, it says, "In Shushan, the citadel," and that just again means the capital, "the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men." That's just in the capital, just in the one city. And in verses 7 through 10, we see that the 500 included the sons of Haman. And so verse 7, verse 8, and verse 9 give those names of the sons of Haman, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, they killed. A couple of things here. This just struck me this week as I studied this, that how close the word Haman is to the word Hamas, which is in the news right now. I mean, I had not even thought about that until this week for some reason. The two names mean separate things, so there's not any, you know, correlation there for the meaning of the name, but the spelling is very, very close. And they are the enemies of the Jews. And the issue here, well, you might think, well, why did the sons of Haman have to be killed? Well, again, as long as they were alive, there was a potential for them to, you know, rebound and make a comeback. And certainly they probably wanted to avenge their father. And so this was a necessary thing that they be killed. But you notice it says there at the end of verse 10, it says, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And that's repeated two times in this section, that they killed who they had to kill. They did what they had to do militarily, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And it's repeated in verse 15 and again in verse 16. And so the question comes up, you know, why is that? And I think it probably has a lot to do with the same thing that we saw with Abram in Sunday's sermon. They didn't want to say that, hey, we took any riches from this. We just did what we had to do, but we didn't want to gain any wealth from this so that anybody could say we did this for the money. And then in verse 12, we see the king's offer. Verse 11, I skipped verse 11. It says, on that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And then in verse 12, the king's offer to Esther, he makes her another offer. He's always, all throughout this book, he's always giving her whatever she wants. He was evidently very taken by her, and so he's just willing to give her whatever she wants. And so in verse 12, it says, the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the citadel and the 10 sons of Haman. And then this is just kind of a question he's probably just asking out loud. I don't think he's asking Esther for the answer to this question, but he says, what have they done in the rest of the provinces? And then he says this, now what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Or what is your further request? It shall be done. And this is the fourth occasion in the book of Esther that he has given her that blank check. Says, fill in whatever you want, it'll be done. And so her request in verse 13, it says, Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow. And there's sort of a repetition here again. You remember she had the banquet, the first banquet that she invited the king and Haman too, and so they come to that banquet and she says, let this be done again tomorrow. Well, you know, there's a pattern here of repetition, but she says, let this be done again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. Now the question comes up here, is she just being vengeful here, or is this a deterrent? Is this something that Mordecai said, hey, you've got this blank check, here's what we'll do. We'll put Haman's sons on display to, you know, strike fear in the heart of everyone so that they'll know not to attack us ever again. Or they may have heard that there was some plot going to come up the next day. But for whatever reason, she asked for that. And so in verses 14 and 15, Ahasuerus grants her request. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And so 500 the first day they killed right in the capital city, and then another 300 the next day. And they took the dead bodies of Haman's sons who were killed the day before, and they put them in the gallows so that everyone in the city could see what had happened. And then in verses 16 and 17, you get the casualty reports from the rest of the empire. Verse 16, the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. Now that seems like a lot of people, and it is, 75,000 deaths. That's no way to minimize that really, but you need to understand that this is a vast empire. It stretched all the way from Africa, all the way across Asia, all the way to India. There was 127 provinces, and some of those provinces were very large and very populated. And so the Jews were ready when this day came. They were ready to defend themselves. And so 75,000 were killed. And the final verse, verse 17, says this was on the 13th day of the month of Adar when this happened. So not on the 14th, which was the second day when they did this in the capital city, but this was on the first day when it was supposed to have been done originally. And on the 14th of the month, they rested and they made it a day of feasting and gladness. And the name of that feast is called Purim. I found out I've been mispronouncing that the whole time. They said it's not Purim. And they said if you say Purim, you're really a novice. You really don't even know how to pronounce anything. But the correct pronunciation is Purim. So we'll try to do it right the rest of the way through. Now, I've got four quick applications for us. Again, we have to put in Psalm 121, verse 4, which is over the whole book of Esther. And it says, "Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep." And so throughout this entire book of Esther, we've seen God at work, never mentioned. But the very fact that he's never mentioned just begins to pound off the page at us that God is involved in all of this. It reminds me of the Russian cosmonaut who went up into space and he said, "Well, I don't see God anywhere." And a few months later, the American astronaut went up and he looked and he said, "I see God everywhere." And that's really the way it is here in the book of Esther. Genesis 12:3 also comes into view here. "I will bless those who bless you," God told Abraham, "and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." I will curse him who curses you. And that's what happened on this day in Persia. I can't help but interject a little commentary at this point. I don't know how many of you saw Chuck Schumer's speech before the Senate this past week. But he was trying to tell Israel what they need to do militarily and trying to stop them from defending themselves, and I kind of laughed. Netanyahu came on a little bit later, and he said several things. He said "The United States of America has always been a close ally of Israel," and he said, "President Trump during his time was a tremendous ally to us. That he moved the embassy to Jerusalem. That you had the Abraham Accords, which brought peace with four of the Arab nations," and he really praised him. And he said, "President Biden has been on our side here." He said, "I don't really know what to think about what Schumer said," but then he said this. He said, "It really doesn't matter because we're going to do what we've got to do here, and it doesn't matter if Trump, Biden, and Schumer all say no." He said, "We're going to do." He didn't say that, but I'm sure that was what he was thinking. But I want to tell you, God is not in a covenant relation with the modern state of Israel. He's in a covenant relation with the kingdom of Israel, which has a king right now. And that king is the Lord Jesus. He's just in exile. But one day he will come and take the throne. And when he does, the people of Israel, there's going to be a mass revival that's going to take place just prior to that. And people of Israel are going to turn to Christ. And so what God is doing is he's protecting the people of Israel for that day that is to come. And he's doing it. The state of Israel is a tool or a vehicle that he's using to protect his people that he's made a promise to through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so that day will come. The third thing that I'd point out is just the hatred of the Jews that we see here. And it's just what we're seeing in our day. And Jews understand it better than any Gentiles do. And they know what they have to do, just like in the story here in Esther. And then finally this, Israel has had a number of never-to-be-forgotten days of reversal in their history. And some of those have been in our lifetime. In 1948, when the United Nations sanctioned Israel and said, you can be a state, you can be an official nation, and they divided the territory between the Palestinians and the Jews in the nation, immediately a war broke out in May of 1948. And all of the countries that surrounded the Jews there in 1948 attacked. And as the world looked on, it took everyone really by surprise in a way, but as the world looked on, everyone would have said, well, that's it. This is not going to last. This new state of Israel is not going to last. Well, 2.5 weeks later, they had pushed the Egyptians all the way back to within 10 miles of Cairo, the capital of Egypt. They had pushed those that had invaded to the north back way beyond the boundaries that the United Nations had set, and they had pushed to the east as far out as you could imagine. And so a great reversal took place. Nobody could understand how that could happen. It made no sense that such a fledgling young state could do that. 1967, some of you old enough to remember the Six-Day War that took place, the same thing happened there. Israel was attacked. It was a sudden attack that was unexpected, but they immediately pushed all of their enemies back, and the enemies were saying, wait a minute, let's have peace here. And so they did for a while. In 1973, the Yom Kippur War, the same thing happened. I ran across an article in Life magazine right after the Six-Day War, and here's how they described it in the magazine. They said, astounding was the only word for it. In 60 hours, the war that exploded upon the Middle East became a fact of history. Tiny Israel stood in the role of victor over the surrounding Arab nations that had vowed to exterminate her. Middle Eastern alliances, balances of power, even political boundaries were of a new shape, as though mutated by a biblical cataclysm. Seldom in military history has victory been so efficient or so visibly decisive in so short a span of time. So swiftly did Israel mount her assault that her adversaries were deprived of the means of winning almost before the world awakened to the fact that a war was in progress. The Israelis experienced an ecstasy which is given to few people of any generation to know. Some people would look at all of this and say, well, it's just world history unfolding. This is just geopolitical forces at work here. But those things don't happen like that. God has his hand in all of that. And so we have to understand that. And I think what we're witnessing right now is right along the same lines. It's a great reversal that's taking place right now as they have gone into the Gaza Strip. And, you know, they're basically saying this is not ever going to happen again. We're not going to put up with this. And I believe God will be with them in it. But I also have to think about reversal days. And the first one I think about is Resurrection Day, which is coming up a week from Sunday. What a reversal day that was. Christ was dead. His disciples with their heads down thinking that all was lost. And then that Sunday morning. And I also think about the future of Christ's return and what a reversal day that will be. It'll be a day of where all the wrongs that have been a part of this life will be made right by the just judge, the righteous judge, the Lord Jesus Christ.